At this time, I'd like to introduce Kathy Donahue, the President of the Holy Family Respect Life Committee and member of the Joint Parish Respect Life Committee.
Thank you, Kevin. I just want to thank everyone for coming today. I know there's a whole handful of different activities happening in our area. And I just wanted to thank you for taking the time out and coming today to hear Monsignor Riley and talk about his mission and to pray for him. Welcome to Holy Family Parish, and on behalf of our Respect Life Committee, I'd like to introduce now Florence Maloney, who is the chair of our Joint Parish Respect Life Committee. And we do meet once a month over in St. Josephat's. And if you want to know anything that's going on within our diocese and within our nation about what's going on in the pro-life movement, this is the meeting to attend, okay? Because there's such an exchange of ideas, and there's such grassroots projects that go on, and we do wonderful things for our diocese. So without any further ado, Dr. Florence Maloney.
So welcome to all, and it is my special privilege to welcome Monsignor Philip Riley to our speaker series today. Some of you may remember that Monsignor Riley was our first speaker for the series on January 22, 2004 at the Immaculate Conception Center in Douglaston. Monsignor set the standard, and we have tried to live up to that standard ever since. Monsignor is well known to many of you here today and does not really need any introduction by me. But for those of you who do not know Monsignor, he became involved in protecting unborn life and the family when opposing groups and individuals began to make significant legislative progress almost 40 years ago. It has been a long and difficult struggle, and much has happened that despite the sorrowful moral state we find our society in, we can be very thankful for the leadership and the spiritual direction provided by Monsignor Riley in forming the Helpers of God's Precious Infants. The Helpers model was able to alter the perception that was promoted in the media that pro-lifers were extremists and intent upon interfering with a woman's right to choose. An objective media would present the truth and the facts, making possible informed opinion and conscience. Such is not the case. However, as we all know only too well, and what can we do, and what should we do about helping women and men to keep their babies and not to be misled by a society that appears to be offering solutions for them, but in reality has taken from them the precious gift of a God-given new life? Just a few weeks ago, Bishop Herman wrote a column I thought you should know. And these are just a few of his words. This is a great time to be a Catholic. This is a great time to witness to such a clear choice, the choice of Christ or the Antichrist. We need to recover our Catholic identity, and we can do it. Monsignor Riley is here today to help us to do just that, to witness for Christ by your witness for life. Monsignor Riley, we welcome you and you.
I'm grateful for your presence here this afternoon. And, the times we're living in are difficult, and you might almost give up hope in the area of life. But I'm going to speak to you today about something that might seem to be a little bit different. I'm going to give you a literary lecture on the genre of epic, because it has everything to do with what we're about. In the papers recently, there was a report of the game between Villanova, between Syracuse and Connecticut, and it went into six overtimes before someone won the game. And they talk about it was an epic struggle, an epic struggle. Tonight on television, starting around 8 o'clock, there's a new program that talks about an epic, a new epic. Well, it's nice, but that's not exactly what the idea of an epic is. And I want to work with you a little bit on that. It's interesting, the great writers in the different literatures, who are considered some of the greatest writers, all wrote in what we call the genre of the epic genre. So you have, in amongst the Greeks, you have Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey. And the greatest work in the classical Latin Western civilization is, of course, is Virgil's Aeneid. And then in Europe, for many, many centuries, it still is, the great work that is others are measured by is Dante's Divine Comedy. They're all epics. Well, epics. Paradise Lost by Milton. And it's interesting because each of these works are interconnected. You could not have the one without the other. So, for example, Homer, when he wrote his work, it was about the fall of Troy. And also called Ilium, the Iliad. And after the fall of Troy and the battles that took place there, the wanderings of Odysseus, the Odyssey. And there were two separate books, but they are joined as one. It's the epic story that the battles and the wanderings of Odysseus. And it was those two books that Virgil, in his Aeneid, he took those two books and he adapted, because when he began to write, the Romans felt inadequate in comparison to the Greeks because they did not have a great epic in their literature. And so he was commissioned by the Emperor Augustus to do so. Now, to write an epic, a real epic, many people start off, as Horace would say, I will sing of arms and the man, Armarum Caicano. And then instead of giving us a great epic, he said, Montes Paturiet et Nascetur Ridiculus Mus. That what you have, it starts off with a mountain in labor, Montes Paturiet, and Nascetur Ridiculus Mus. A ridiculous mouse is born. It starts off, it's almost impossible to write an epic, because to write an epic that is really a masterpiece, first of all, you need universal knowledge in all areas of your culture at the time. You need absolute mastery of your language, artistry to be a poet. And then to write an epic, you need, which is the most important part, I believe, is a contemplative soul, because you're reflecting on the human condition. You see, most of what we're exposed to in terms of literature is realistic literature, whether it be programs we watch on TV, whether it be movies, novels. And realistic literature can it be entertaining, can move you to tears, it can frighten you, it can inspire you, but it rarely gives you wisdom. Because realistic literature gives you a slice of life. It doesn't give you the whole. And if you do not see the part in relation to the whole, you lack wisdom. So you see the whole, you understand where the part fits in. You see the part, you understand the whole. And to do that is incredibly difficult. It's interesting, Pope Paul VI, when he wrote Humanae Vitae, in section 7, He said the problem with people making moral judgments today is they make it in terms of not seeing the whole. They see it in terms of parts. So, for example, it's okay to use, he says, money to contraceptives for the sake of health, or because of population, or because of economic conditions, or because of. He said, you can't make a moral judgment apart from seeing and asking a more profound question, who is man? And that this action itself, is it in conformity with the very purpose, the nature of the what the human being is? It's only in the light of the whole that you can make a proper moral judgment. And so it is that when you have an epic, the poet begins by saying, which is very difficult, he asks for inspiration from the gods, from the muse. And he begins, as Aeneas, in the Aeneid, Virgil begins by asking profound questions. He says, arma verumque cano. I'm going to sing of arms of the man who, qui primus, Troy qui primus, who was the first one who came from the shores of Troy to Latium. I won't talk about this man who came as the result of an outcast by fate, fata profugus, in exile by fate. And he had to experience the anger of the gods. So he asks questions, and the questions he asks is this. He says, why did Troy fall? Why did Aeneas, this outstanding man of pietas, of goodness, of virtue, why did he suffer so much? Why did he, when he was about to finish his task arriving at Rome, everything was turned upside down? He asked the question, what type of gods do we have? Is God insane? Irrational? How could you make a good man suffer? And this idea of fate. You know, the name of the helpers is the helpers of God's precious infants. And the word infants comes from a Latin word, forfari fatuus, which means to speak. Forfari fatuus. And the present participle of the verb forfari is fans, fantis, to speak. And when you put a prefix in front of it, it intensifies it, or it changes it, you see, or it negates it. In this case, it negates it. So if you are speaking, it's fans fontis, but if you cannot speak, it's infans. So an infant is one who cannot speak. So if you join the army and you are to take orders and not to speak, you're put into the infantry. That's the way it goes. If you are, so an infant is one who's not able to speak. So these infants, however, are precious because they belong to God. God's precious infants. And we try to help God's precious infants. So that word forfari fatuus means, also comes the very word we call infant. One who cannot speak, needs someone to speak on its behalf. Needs someone to make it visible, to speak out for it. But the word forfari fatuus means literally to speak. And the past participle, fatus, is that which has been spoken, which has been decreed. From that we get the English word fate. Fate. And that which has been decreed or is fixed, you cannot change. And Virgil saw and understood that why do things happen? What is going on? Well, all the way running through all the great works is the word fatus, fate. And he believed, with a Stoic-type philosophy, that that which was moving the world, driving the world, was some type of a spiritual principle. It was hard for those before Christ to to imagine something existing that was totally spiritual. So he tended to, in some ways, incarnate it, a fiery principle, this force that moved the world. But it was rational. And when it was eventually identified with Jupiter, what Jupiter has spoken, but what he has spoken, Fatuus, fate, he himself is even bound by. But they believed that there was an order, a plan, a rational force moving the world. And in this ordered reality, moving towards this ultimate purpose, that you would not, the most important thing for us was to do what the fates intend. Now, how can you do what is the fates intend? Well, it's a rational force. So when a person acts according to reason, they're acting in accordance with the fates. They're acting in accordance with what is to be best. That we do the same thing. In Christianity, we say that God created the world. And God created the world, and he made us from nothing, and he makes us with a purpose. And God, who is incredibly intelligent, has a purpose. God is not only the creator, but he is the conserver, he is a governor. So that there is not only did God make you, you could not be sitting here unless God kept you in existence right now. And not only did he make you and have you in existence right now, he has a plan for you. It's being worked out. There's a governance. See? And it's a rational world. It's an intelligent world we're in. Now, we speak of say, physical necessity, that most of what God made, it arrives at its perfection. It arrives at its perfection by acting according to its nature automatically. So the tree grows, the birds sing. They act according to their nature out of necessity, a physical necessity. When it comes to man, God said, let's make him different. Let's make him different. We will give to man a share in a higher way of existing. Make him in the image of God, a spirit. And with that spirit comes your mind, comes your intellect, comes your will. And with your mind, you can now think. You can know. So when you act rationally, you're acting in conformity with God's eternal plan, which is wisdom, moved by wisdom, intelligence. And you are moving towards perfection, or what God made you for, by using your intellect. And then when you know what you are, God said, I also give you a free will, so that you can freely act according to knowing what you are. So for us, one freedom is to act, to do what one ought to do. And that is a moral necessity. There's no choice. If we do not, we destroy ourselves. So man's great dignity is that he is able to know the force moving the world, so to speak, Fata. He is able to act in conformity with God's eternal plan, and to do it freely, and to give a praise to God, and to reach a perfection that the things which are of the physical necessity are not able to do. They're able to do it, they do it automatically, but we do it freely, knowingly, and we give a greater praise to God. Now, we also know that as a result of the original sin, that it is difficult for man sometimes to know. His intellect becomes blinded. We also know as a result of the original sin that there is within ourselves movements against doing what is correct and right, the concupiscence. We also know as a result of original sin, man can start to really adore the creation rather than the creator, become enslaved. We also know as a result of original sin, there is a spirit that is not of God, a poor spirit, that man is attempted and can be led by and enslaved by. These are realities. Now, when Virgil writes the Aeneid, he asks the profound questions of why does a good man suffer? And he is going to sing about heroes, Virum, the man, and battles, and he begins before it asking God to inspire him to know, are the gods insane? Is there a plan? Is there a purpose? How does this work? Why are we here? What's our purpose? And then what does he do? He tells a story. He begins to tell the story. And it's incredibly important that you remember the questions as you read the story. Because it's in the story you're going to find the answers to the questions. And so he begins with Aeneas, and he is in the final lap of his journey to establish a new Troy, Rome. And just as he's about to do so, the old enemy of Troy, Juno, goes to the king of the winds, Aeolus, and she requests of him, would he do her a favor? And she bribes him. Would he let loose all the winds and take Aeneas and his ships and his people and just sink them and drive them into the ground in this last lap of their journey? And so suddenly, after all their struggles and everything seems now within sight, they're going to accomplish it. Everything is turned upside down. He ends up shipwrecked in an area called Libya. It's an area in the northern part of Africa, not far from the city, in a building called Carthage. And we find the first words of our hero, is saying, O thrice and four times blessed are those who are dead. That's the hero. It's quite different. Quite human. Because all of the efforts that he has made, all the sacrifices that they have made, suddenly, it's being snatched from them. It's being destroyed. It's all the winds Aeolus lets loose from all the corners of the earth, and it just lifts up tidal waves of death and dashes them upon the shore, and it seems to be a hopeless, helpless condition. I think of that in our pro-life movement. 40 years of efforts. 40 years. In the past 40 days, I know people are worried about the stock market going up and down. I'm not. Those things take care of themselves. I'm worried about the stocks on life. They have gone down with a crash that you cannot believe. If you have been following what this new administration has been doing, it is frightening, you see? In other words, what has happened is that in every direction, it's a scorched earth policy that's being imposed upon us. Take no prisoners. In every area, there's not a single pro-life person being appointed. Everything is undoing and what has been done and unleashing an incredible tidal wave of death. That is very frightening. And you would almost say, forget it, or thrice and four times blessed are those who are not going to see this. You see? Not going to see this. God help our children who are coming after us. My God. You see? And it's that mentality that Aeneas had at the beginning of this epic journey. But you see, and you say, well, where is this going? Why? Why is this? Well, there's a reason for it, and Virgil is able to see this with a contemplative soul. He was a person who was called in the Middle Ages the pagan John the Baptist. And it's rather interesting. After he wrote his book, he lived from 70 BC to 19 BC. And when he died, because it wasn't totally complete, he was going to not just destroy it. And Augustus the Emperor said, no, this work will become in every classroom throughout the empire immediately. And so the Virgil's Aeneid was the most read book right up at the time of Christ and right up into the Middle Ages. And he was known as the pagan John the Baptist because he began to understand, and he saw a vision, an understanding of reality, that there was a rational force moving the world. And it was through suffering, that growth takes place. It's in nature. The seed must, our Lord says, falls into the ground and dies. It remains, it doesn't grow. Right? Why does one civilization like Troy fall? Because if it doesn't, you will not have Rome. Why do you go through various ages and periods in your life? Because you cannot always remain a child. If you remain a child, you never become a young adult. A young adult, you become a mature person. And there's a process going on, and there's a purpose, but it always involves a dying, a suffering, a sacrifice. But through it all, the providence, the plan of God, is being worked out. It's interesting, even in the Divine Comedy, in Dante. If you recall, it opens in the first book, The Inferno, it opens with Dante in the woods, in darkness, a broken life. And he just doesn't know himself. He comes out of the woods and he sees this mountain. And he says, he goes to go climb the mountain, and the beast won't let him go up the mountain. And he comes, and who comes along but Virgil? Virgil. And it's Virgil who then leads him down into the Inferno, to hell, to Purgatorio. And eventually, when he goes to go up the mountain, reason can take you so far. Beatrice comes on the scene, and it's faith, and she brings him last journey. But why did he have to go down? Because this is found in the Aeneid. That's where he based his whole Divine Comedy on. Virgil, that's why Virgil led him. In the Aeneid, we find out that this so-called good man, and he is not yet ready to be the leader. He has to learn an awful lot yet. He has to go through a lot of suffering. He has to come to the point of real maturity. And so it is in the sixth book of the Aeneid, we have Aeneas going down into the underworld. And in the underworld, he meets his own life in the reversal. And he begins to see things as they really are. And he begins to grow and to mature. And finally, at the end of the sixth book, his father, Anchises, tells him, "Now I can tell you your mission. You're now ready." And your mission, because now you are a man, the Pietas. And until now, you are not yet ready to enter into this struggle. The mission is this: you must remove everything that is against the faith, against reason. What is that? It's furor, it's irrationality that causes the great suffering. When people act unreasonable, when people do not act according to how God made them. And it's personified in the great hero Turnus. And so the first six books of the Aeneid are based on the Odyssey of Homer, in a superficial way, but much more profound. And the last six books are based on the Iliad, in which the battle between madness, irrationality, and reason takes place. And he has to crush and put the great contribution that Rome is to give to the world. And what is the great contribution that Rome is to give to the world? He says it is the peace of Augustus that comes from a just laws. Just laws in which the rights and duties of people are truly protected and expressed. And unless we have that, we will not have peace. And he said the great contribution that Rome gave, the Latin race gave to the world, was the gift of law with rights and duties. And if you do not have rational laws based on what we are, we will destroy ourselves because madness and furor will take over. You know, at the present time, we have a real problem. We have a problem of removing from the law everything that is rational and good. We call it ethical relativism. We call it not tolerance. What we're talking about is this: we have said, instead of the enthronement of truth, in our laws. We have reversed that. Now, what do you give to your children? Think about this. The things that you give to your children that really make them rich, you and the poor can give. What is it that is that which makes a child rich? If you have given the gift of life, and you have given to that child how to live life, wisdom, and you have loved that child is rich. If that child can say, I was given life by my parents, they told me and taught me how to live, and they loved me. The poor can do that. That's the most important thing you grant to your children. But how to live? You taught your child how to live early on. This is what we do in this home. This is our customs. This is what we do. And in the customs and the traditions, you find wisdom. You teach that. And then a people, you don't have to start a new generation learning from nothing how to live. God help us if that was the situation, but that's what it's getting to. Because what we normally would do is the customs, the morals that people have learned over centuries and millenniums of what is it that is the duties and rights to each other. Where does wisdom lie? Where is truth? We hand that gift on to the next generation in the law. Virgil saw that. And if you do not hand on in the law the proper rights and duties to each other, then you have chaos. You have madness. Your self-destruction. And so what has been happening is this. We have come with this type of philosophical background and say, well, it's not really capable of knowing. We're not really capable of knowing the truth. Therefore, all truth is subjective. Because it is subjective, we should not impose your subjective truth on somebody else. And so, every time we find a moral value, how to live life, a truth, we find someone brings it to a judge who says, well, this is imposing on someone who does not have that value, this value. Therefore, it has to be removed. And little by little, what we are removing from the law is all values. It is our traditions. It is wisdom. And so you end up with a whole, what Virgil saw as the great gift of Rome to the world was the gift of law, in which people were able to know from the beginning what's right, what's wrong, and to bring about a holy and good society. Now, this gift of law, it is actually at the present time, the most basic things we know is that the law must protect life. It must take each individual as a nice statistic. When a baby is born, it's not a statistic. It's a unique event. Every person here is an absolute unique event that required a special act of creation on the part of God. And a continuous keeping you in existence, conserving you. In other words, the idea of creation is not something that happened, it's ongoing. And when you came into existence, the world was altered and will never be the same again. And this new existence, the person that is brought into existence has a purpose, and this purpose is to be brought to perfection. So that what we have is the whole purpose of life is that this child that is born is absolutely unique in all the world. It is precious to God, and it must be treated with dignity and respect. We are losing that. We're making people into statistics. We're making people into that a life is not precious. because we've lost the sense of the dignity and the worth of the individual life, because we've lost the sense of God the Creator, God the Conserver, the governance and the plan of God, and that we can know it, and it should be implanted in our homes, in our laws, and it is that which saves us. If we do not, it will be that which will destroy us. It will be that which will destroy us. So what is happening today is not simply that unborn children are not being protected, it's destroying the very fabric of society. It's something that is going to bring us all down, because madness is taking over. We're putting into the laws that which is insane. It's what the Romans would say, it's furor, it's ira, it's anti-faith. And those who go against the faith, that's that which has been spoken, the wisdom of God, it's only a matter of time before you become a tragic figure. A tragic figure. And so Virgil had to learn this. Virgil, it shows that Aeneas had to learn this. And when he became mature enough that he was ready to do the battle, then the mission was given to him, and we find out why did the good man suffer? He suffered because he was not yet ready to be the hero. He was not yet ready for the mission that God was going to give to him. And the suffering was actually the dying to the old man, the putting on the new man. Now this idea of epic, in which you only in the light of the whole can you see the parts. So for example, in book 4, he arrives at this place called Carthage, and he's sort of depressed, giving up hope, and he meets this woman called Dido, the queen. And she too has suffered much. She has been a person who has lost her city and has in exile and meeting a people trying to establish a new city. But the two of them are young. The two of them are attracted to each other. They're both bright, etc. And so it's a natural thing that they would come together, except that both of them have a mission that doesn't allow this to happen. She must lead her people, and he must take his men and go to Rome. But eventually they fall in love, and nothing seems to be stopping this relationship. Until finally what happens is that Mercury is sent by Jupiter. The king of the gods sends his messenger to say to Aeneas, get out of there. And she says, if you leave, I'll kill myself. But he has to leave. And he does. And she kills herself. And you say, well, my God, that is it's awful. And Anna, her sister, when she saw she was falling in love and she was weeping and crying to her sister Anna, saying, I know I've been there before, I see what's happening to me, but I shouldn't be doing this. And Anna was a person who could not resist tears. And so she told her sister Dido whatever she wanted to hear. But at the end, you can't do that. It's not a matter of emotions and feelings to determine what's right or wrong. It's a matter of what is right or wrong, and we have to be able to say that. When Dido ends up taking her life, who does she curse and said, this, you brought this evil upon me? Anna. And Aeneas is leaving, and she sees his ships, and she says, I'm going to kill him. But then she decides, why should I make my people suffer? And if you just see that slice of life, you would say, how could Aeneas do such a thing? Why did he not stay? How he caused the death of Dido, etc. But in the light of the whole epic, if Aeneas stayed there, he should not have got involved with it to begin with. But it was right for him to leave. And you see it only in the light of the whole, when the great city of Rome is finally brought to established, and this new gift to mankind, the laws, the source of peace and of Augustus, is finally given to all mankind, that you understand in the light of the whole that made sense, that he had to leave. He shouldn't have stayed to start with, but having stayed, he should leave. Now I mention that because there's another epic, written in an epic, and the epic is the Bible. It's the Bible. The Bible is a story, and in the story we must understand the most basic questions. What is taking place? The Bible is that there is a plan of God being worked out through all the sufferings, all the exiles. We know from the very beginning of the story that man was found in a condition of pristine purity, immortality, friendship with God, God's life, everything from the very beginning. And he lost it because of pride. He lost it because of the devil. And then we're told that God would send a woman, whose son would crush the head of the serpent and restore a new creation, a new creation. So once you have this new creation, you find it in the book of Apocalypse, the woman clothed with the sun. And her son is the one who crushes the head of the serpent, the dragon. And the dragon continues to fight all the offspring. What you have is, in the Bible, it's the story of humanity, of mankind, of the death and the rising. And each one in the process, okay, they are filled with hope. Abraham starts with hoping against hope. Mary, the woman of hope of the New Testament, as Abraham was of the Old Testament. And each one is doing what they are to bring about this new creation in Christ, to establish this new plan of God, to bring about the new creation. Each one is to be faithful in faith and hope where they're at. They will not see it. Aeneas did not see Rome. He laid the foundations. Abraham did not see his offspring. He laid the foundations. Mary did not see the church today. Right? Laid the foundations. And each one, if you are faithful in the process, that's more important than to understand, I must do my thing, totally autonomous. No, we are a community, a people, a plan of God, which interlocks and dependent one another. And each of us in faith must live our moment for the sake of that which is to come, totally convinced in hope it will be a better days ahead. Perhaps even these things will someday be a joy to recall. Stay strong. We are now in exile without moving. Our whole culture has been taken from us. It's a culture of death. And we now are called upon, like the people of old who were in exile, people of faith. We must maintain the light. We must maintain our perspective and keep the light burning for the sake of those who will come after us, that we not cut off this chain, that we not give up, that we not at this point say, oh, poor me. No, blessed are you. You are being tested. You are the ones who God is trying. But you and I must maintain hope and faith that there is a plan of God being worked out and better days are ahead. And it will be because of you that people look back and say, when the light went out, and it was almost total darkness, there was someone, some people, who refused to let the light go totally out, the light of life. They kept their focus on, we will be faithful, even if we appear to see not to be successful. We will continue to be faithful, and another great people will rise up of life. There'll be a new generation of people. So this is very important, that we don't just weigh what is happening to us in the light of the immediate present. See where we have come from, see where it is going. See the eternal plan of God. Know that you are people of being tested of faith like the great prophets of old, like the great people in the past, who in the midst of chaos and darkness and persecution, they did not let the faith die. They did not let the vision disappear. And this is incredibly important for us. And we have reason for hope beyond that. Because the reality is this, is that our past Holy Father, John Paul II, in Evangelium Vitae, he said, I give you a commission, a command. He said, look, you are in a culture of death. I am not asking you to change the laws and protect life. Do so if you can. But no, that's not too easy right now. The commission, the command I give to you now is to establish and promote a culture of life. Not to protect. If we could, we would, but right now we can't. protect life with the laws. But what good is the law if no one follows it? What good is this? In other words, we reach the point where, you know, we have laws, but no one's keeping them. Look at the laws of the church. What we have to do is re-establish a culture that no one pays attention to the rotten laws, which are immoral. And they live good, holy lives, and they respect life. And we, as helpers, for the past 20 years, have been so conscious of that. We spend about 10% of our time trying to change the laws. Because I've been in this 42 years. And after 21 years, I realized we're in a culture of death. And so the main thrust we put and try to do is for moving from the streets of God's people all over the world, of changing hearts, of establishing a culture of life, of having young people to see that there are, in spite of the darkness, in spite of the war, in spite of everything, there are people who believe in the value and the sacredness and the uniqueness of every single human life. And every human life is precious because it belongs to God. And we will help that precious life in the mothers. And we will keep the fire burning. And so God has a movement. A movement, and it started here in Brooklyn. The Diocese of Brooklyn. But it is spread through the world. It is spread through the world. And it's a movement from the streets, as all social movements ultimately win. And it's a movement that is peaceful, it is prayerful, it is courageous. I was mentioned just recently that it's very interesting. If you go to a novena, usually it's about 20 people there, 18 women and 2 men. If you come to help us prayer vigil, you may find the opposite. Because there's a certain manly thing about asking a man to stand up for his faith. Go out to the streets. Give witness to God and to others, you see, of the sickness of life. You know, people before were embarrassed to make the sign of the cross in a restaurant before eating. Those same people now are kneeling in the gutter in the middle of Queens Boulevard. There's courage. There's a tremendous transformation. And they're there praying. They're bearing witness of the presence. Where prayerful presence is the presence of God. And we cannot succeed. We cannot succeed except by God helping us, because it's not a matter of just being reasonable, as in the Aeneid. We know something beyond that is necessary. It's called the grace of God. We know the answer to a battle, to the victory, is Jesus Christ. Because the world needs a Savior. Not just reason, a Savior. Because we can know the truth and not act on it. We can be impelled by forces within us to act against the truth. We can be over-attached. People can lie and break all the commandments of God. We need the grace of God that comes through Jesus Christ. Not us, the whole world does. The whole world. We have to bring to the world Jesus Christ. He who is the way, the truth, and the life. We have to bring to the world not just knowledge. Knowledge alone will not do it. It needs the grace of God for people to act in the truth. And without the grace of God, we will not be able to succeed, nor will they. So the answer is the same. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow, it's a person, it's Jesus Christ. That is the culture of life. And the intercession of His Mother, our Blessed Lady. And so our approach is rather simple. We bring to the problem our poor weakness, our frailty, but we bring the power of God. As Almighty God, when He first came into the world, He asked Mary for two permissions. He said, "Mary, would you do me a favor? I want to be incarnated. Will you say, give me permission?" She said, "Yes." And the Word took flesh. He said, "Mary, I have a second permission. Would you bring me to the world?" And she did. It was called Golgotha. And she gave her Son to the world. God asks us today for two permissions. First, may I live within you. We say yes. It's called Holy Communion. And then He says, "I have another permission I want to ask. Would you bring me to the world today? In my risen body, I cannot do this. I only can do it through my mystical body, but I want to do the will of my Father. And I want you to bring me where? I want you to bring me to Calvary. The place where innocent blood is being shed today. The place where it's midnight, it's darkest. Bring me there. But it's dangerous. I know. You could be killed. I know. I want to go there in love for the people who are going to kill me. Is that interesting? You know, when Our Lady was standing at the foot of the cross, she was his mother. If you think a mother didn't speak to her son during that period of time, you're out of your mind. And I'm sure she spoke to Jesus. And we're told by John, she stood. She wasn't on the ground screaming, yelling, crying. She was strong. She knew her son was a priest. She knew at this moment the world was being redeemed. She knew his priesthood was this, was it. The finest hours of his life, as his father saw him now, hanging on a cross, he was redeeming the world. And I said, I know what Mary said to her, to his son. She said, Jesus, you stay right on that cross. I'll pray you through. John will pray with you too. Jesus did not die alone. He was surrounded by love and compassion and prayer. He's surrounded by Mary Magdalene, the other woman, John, Mary. And he stood on the cross, and it was not the end, it was the beginning. He died, but he will rise from the dead. And we are called today to continue the work of Jesus Christ. They believe because when he was dying and they were cursing him and mocking him, he would say, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. And eventually, before we're told, both thieves were cursing Jesus in Matthew. And we're told in Luke, by the end, one of the thieves heard, Father, forgive them. He saw Mary and John. And he said, he is a king. Remember, you went into your kingdom. For the centurion, it took actually the death of Jesus before he said, truly, this was the Son of God. Many times I tell you this, women are so caught up in this culture of death that it's not until the child dies that they know it was wrong. Truly, this was a child of God. Oh my God, what have I done? And then they believe. And so it's incredibly important for God's people that we be there not to save the physical life of babies, that we be there to save souls, that we be there with Christ's love and compassion before and after an abortion, that we be there as the sign of hope. And we are privileged to be there. We are called to make present the visible sacrifice of Jesus Christ in us, victims with Christ. Why did they believe the first ones? Because they saw, they could touch and taste and feel God's compassionate, merciful love in Jesus hanging on the cross. It moved their hearts. And people will only believe if they meet Christians, witnesses of that same, that are willing to give flesh and blood, that when we're cursed and we're mocked and rejected, that we respond in like with love and compassion. And then they will believe. They'll say, how do you do this? Then you can tell them about a person, Jesus Christ, about how he stood present with us in the Eucharist. And if you receive the Eucharist, you too can do this. And the conversions will begin. The conversions will begin. We need to go to the people in the darkness, not to talk to one another, not simply to change the law. That's cutting out, copping out. The people who need us most is not the law, not the people who know, the people who do not know, the people in darkness. That's where Jesus wanted to go. That's where everything happens. And God is calling us today. He's calling us, well, I should say Jesus wants to. Jesus wants through us to go to Golgotha, to the place where people are most in need, to where it's darkest, where it's midnight and midday. This is where God wants us to be, and to bring Jesus Christ, the love of Mary, the mercy and hope that is present within us. And when we go, it may seem we fail. We never fail. If you do in faith, and you are faithful to the end, it's not the end. John walking away with Mary back to the city. Imagine John saying, well, that was a loss. And Mary turning to him and saying, John, it has just begun. And so we continue. Even if we do not succeed, we will go because there will be success. For out of the blood of Christians comes the growth of Christianity. It's out of the death comes the rising. It is total faith in the providence of God that this is just the hour of darkness, but there'll be a new day, a new dawn, and the people who will have that will look back upon you and all those who stood with Christ at the cross publicly in the public streets, giving witness to Jesus, Lord of life. For we know that death will give way to life, hate will give way to love, hope will overcome despair, and the mercy of God will succeed. And when we do that, we become truly Christians. When we do that, we finally become what we ought to be. And when we do that, there is a story that continues after we die. And that brings the story to completion when we reach the promised land, when we see the victory in Christ in eternity, that you are faithful unto the end. Blessed are you. And I say this afternoon, be faithful to the end. And do not think that this is, that darkness is winning. It's only an hour of darkness. A new day will dawn. God bless you.
Here with the heart.